All right, so that should be going. Well, my name is Mason Farr. I'm the Education Manager at the National Veterans Memorial Museum, and I'm here with John Looker. And so, John, if you want to introduce yourself, and then we'll go from there.
John Looker, and I was in Vietnam 1968 to 1969 with the group of 1st Cav. And what the 1st Cav did was they transported us from firefight to firefight the entire time we were there. So we were in a lot of different firefights in the entire time. During the time I was there, I got wounded 3 times. It was a bad month in the Eshaw Valley that we were down there. We went down there in March, and I was wounded on March the 4th with shrapnel in my back. March the 6th with shrapnel on my back. March the 9th was the day I got a gunshot wound to my right shoulder. And that particular night was the Battle of Angel's Wing. And the reason they called it Angel's Wing was it looked like an angel's wing where we were at. And we were there. My good friend Earl Longstreth was with me the entire time that I was in Vietnam, and also Billy Baham. Earl was from Pennsylvania, Billy was from California. And on March the 8th, Earl had served so much time in country that he was completely out of the service. But he wouldn't hardly leave because he didn't want to leave his buddies behind. So he left on a helicopter around noon, and we got a new recruit. And we were, because we always slept 3 in a foxhole. And the new recruit's name was Alton. And Alton was he'd just gotten to country, had his brand new spitshine boots and everything on. And that particular evening before, from the 8th, about midnight, he saw people walking on a trail that was close to us. So shortly after that, we started receiving a lot of gunfire. And we were set up in a rice paddy, which wasn't usually the best place to set up in. And wasn't shortly thereafter, there was a ravine that was about 30 yards away from us that we were able to get into after the original battle started. And we got into the ravine, and we started out large, ended up getting smaller and smaller as we kept losing men. And Billy, well, I need to go back and talk about Alton. Like I said, he was on guard duty. You pull guard duty 2 hours off 4. He was on guard duty. Thought he'd seen somebody on the path. And he was the first one killed that night. When he was between Billy and I. And he took a headshot. Was killed immediately. So this young man was in country 24 hours, maybe a little bit longer, but he was going home in a body bag, which was pretty traumatic. And anyhow, we got into the ravine about 4 o'clock that morning. I got a gunshot wound to the right shoulder. And when I got that gunshot wound, the medic, we called him Doc Morgan, came over and gave me a morphine shot to help ease the pain a little bit. But I was pretty lucky because it was a tracer round, and it kind of fused it as it went through. So, but it was still bleeding a lot. And Billy, as we was moving closer and closer in that ravine, would pick me up and move me and set me down and put his t-shirt on me and sat on my shoulder to help stop the bleeding. Well, we couldn't get any support from the base camp because we were surrounded. And later on we found out from one of the captains that was over our group that there was about 500 North Vietnamese and Viet Cong that had us surrounded. So we were lucky to have any of us get out alive, but they couldn't put any firepower out to us. All they could send was illumination rounds, and all that did was make you see them, mm-hmm. and they were between 25, 30 yards out away from you, so you could see them setting up their mortars and all that stuff. So it scared you more than it helped you. But anyhow, they started getting closer and closer, and they were within probably 25 feet of where we were at. And about 6 o'clock that morning, daylight came, and the Cobras were able to come in, and they kind of cleaned up the area so we could get the medevac helicopters in. And about 6:30, I was able to get on one of the medevac helicopters and taken back to base camp. And when the corpsman loaded me up, my right shoulder was down on the side. And my buddy Billy said, put his arm on his chest. And the guy told him he's going to lose that arm anyhow. So Billy pulled out his .45 and said, I told you to get his arm on his chest. So he did. I made it back to the base camp or field hospital. And at the field hospital, there was a nurse there. The only thing I remember, I don't remember the flight back. All I remember is laying on the gurney and looked up, and there was this beautiful blonde nurse there. Her name was Cisco, and she was holding my hand. And I looked up at her and said, when I wake up, will you still be holding my hand? And she says, yes, I will. But I was calling her Crisco instead of Cisco. So anyhow, the next morning, I woke up, and here was Earl. He hadn't left the country yet. Just screaming and hollering at me, I can't leave you for one day. Not for one day. I said, yeah, Earl, you're right. So then, after I left the field hospital, they took me to Guam. And at Guam, I spent some time in Guam. And then they transferred me to Valley Forge Hospital in Pennsylvania. And Valley Forge Hospital was really nice. But I didn't have to come home to, like a lot of them did, to San Francisco, where they were spit on, called baby killers, and they threw rotten eggs at them and all that. I came home on a hospital plane straight to Valley Forge. And the other thing that was lucky for me is Earl only lived about 45 minutes from that hospital. So once I was able to get up and get out, he would pick me up and take me back to his mom and dad's house that had a nice big swimming pool and a refrigerator full of beer and young women running around in their bathing suits. So that was very nice. And he'd pick me up and then take me back after the weekend was over. And it made my stay a little better. But I was married at the time, and I wouldn't let my wife or my mom and dad or anybody come and see me at Valley Forge because it was just so horrible. All the people with missing legs, missing arms, and in a lot worse shape than I was, I guess. But I wouldn't let them come and see that. And then on July, I think it was the 11th, July 11th, they released me from the hospital, and I was able to go back home. And it's such a different situation going back home. People thought you were on vacation. And I had a real tough time talking to anybody about all the firefights I'd been in while I was over in Vietnam or anything. Even my friends that served in Vietnam, we had a tough time even talking to each other about it. But first 5 years after I was back, I was a horrible person. I was drinking. I'd stay out weeks at a time, or go out on Friday and not come home till Monday. Just a horrible person. And we had, in the last year of our marriage, we had a child, and she was about 6 months old. And finally my wife got tired of me running around and being an alcoholic. So I came home one after a weekend binge, and all the doors were locked and all my clothes were out on the sidewalk. So I had my 55 Nomad wagon and my clothes, and that's what I left with. Shortly after that, we got together and I talked to her and I told her that I didn't want our daughter to know me because I was such a horrible person. And she really didn't know me until about her 16th birthday. My grandfather had died, and Charlene, my wife, and her came to the funeral. And she knew that she must know me, but she didn't know who I was. And it was good, but shortly thereafter, I don't know, I was helping a friend. We were going to have a surprise 50th birthday party for him, and they wanted me to keep him away so I could get him there for the surprise. And I was sitting at the bar with him, and this young woman came up to me, and she said, "You don't know who I am, do you?" I said, "I'm sorry, young lady, I don't." She said, "I'm your daughter." So that was pretty devastating to me, because that's one of the things I was having the nightmares about, was how bad I was, how I treated them. So after 5 years of that, and me being free, or not free, single, I guess, I ran into a young lady that went to school with, and her and I hung out a lot together while we were juniors and seniors. And one night I was at a bar, and I was there with two women, because that's who I lived with, was two women at the time. And she came up to me and said, "Want to go back to my place and play some cards?" Well, two of our good friends, both of our friends, were there, and sure enough, I went back and played cards, and that was the last I saw those two women, and started dating my wife, Kathy. And we've been married now for 51 years, and she is the one that really, I think, saved me from being an alcoholic or committing suicide or whatever, because she's been so good to me throughout all these years, even as bad as I am. I got a lot of vices, but she has been so great to me. And she had a daughter, her name is Jamie, that from a previous marriage. And I adopted her when she was 2 years old. And Jamie has followed me all over the country. When I go to reunions for the first cab and stuff, she goes with me, because my wife she spends about 22 hours a day on the couch, so she's not doing very well, but My daughter follows me all over the country, and she's going with me to St. Louis in October. We have another reunion out there. But my daughter comes to, like, I've been, you know, chairman of the Memorial Day parades, the Veterans Day stuff for years. And she always goes with me to keep me from going insane, I guess. But anyhow, through them, I think that's what broke me loose. And then Kathy and I have had a child named Adam that both of my children now are, my daughter Jamie is 54. My son Adam just turned 50. And it's just been, we've done a lot of things together, and I involve myself in a lot of different volunteering opportunities. And I think that that's just helped me to keep busy and not have to think about all the other things that are in the back of my mind. I have quite a few different horrible dreams that I have. The first one was in 1968, May. It was on Mother's Day. We called it the Mother's Day Massacre. And we got into a pretty heavy firefight, and one of our, the guy that was walking point at the time, got wounded in the head. And I didn't know how serious his wounds were or whatever, so Earl and I went out to get the sniper. We finally got him. He was gut shot, so they were lowering a net down to take him out of there, and I was carrying him back, and I kept yelling, "You bastard, you bastard, you bastard." Well, that they identified that as being battle fatigue or psychic or whatever, so they sent me back to a base camp, and I spent 3 days back there being evaluated as to whether I was go back in or not. But they let me back in the field after 3 days. And the next one came, I mean, we had a lot of bad firefights. And the other one that really bothers me a lot is we had a lieutenant come into our group. We'd just been out on a 45-day mission, so we were, you know, we hadn't changed clothes, socks, you know, you'd wash them out in the stream, and that was about it. And when we came in, they loaded us right next to the helicopter pad, which was throwing dust and dirt and everything all over us. And we no more and got our packs down. And this sergeant came over and says, "Looker, Longstreth, Bayham, front and center, bring your weapons." I said, "We just got here. I just wanted to sit for a few minutes." But anyhow, he took us out to this truck, a flatbed truck. Said, "Get up in the back of that." Well, we got down the road a little bit, and the lieutenant got out. Lieutenant Guy got out, and he said, "Gentlemen," says, "there's cold beer, cold soft drinks, and a little bit to eat back there. I wanted to go get a bath, and there's a creek down the way here, so you protect me while I'm there." So we did that, and we were able to get in and get washed up a little bit and cleaned up a little bit, which was really nice. And then we came back to the landing zone where we were at, and 2 days later, we were in a rubber tree plantation, and we started getting fire from a bunker. The lieutenant guy was between myself and Bill or Earl, and he thought he was charged the bunker. Well, he didn't get two steps out, and he was shot in the head. So Earl and I circled around and finally got to the bunker and got those that were in there. And but that's one of the most frequent ones. And then the other one, of course, is the Angels Wing battle. And there was 11 killed that night and 38 wounded. And I mentioned the 11 that were killed in every memorial speech I do, or veterans, just try to recognize them. But if, and I try to get to the Vietnam Traveling Wall, wherever it's at. I've spoken up in Sydney, Ohio, when it came in the first time in 2010, when it came back in 2015, and then again in 2020, when it came back again. And that's when I brought Guy Grutter down. And he was prisoner of war for 5 years and 3 months. And because I've gotten to know Guy through a non-profit that he and I both went in 2016, which is called Blue Skies for Good Guys and Gals. And what we do is we bring in about 50 Purple Heart recipients, Gold Star families, and first responder families for a weekend to remember in August. And we do it down in Middletown, and they can jump out of an airplane, because that's one of the sponsors, is the parachutist there. We bring in all kinds of aircraft and helicopters and whatever, and you can fly in them and do this or that. And then we always have an evening where we bring in somebody to entertain everybody. But it's, and have a big bonfire. But it's a great weekend. Like I said, I went in 2016. And in 2016, I was still in a bad place. I just didn't feel good about myself. But after going through this program, because what they do is they assign you an ambassador. And that ambassador sticks with you and walks you through. And
is that ambassador also a veteran?
Yes. Okay. And yeah, it's either, like I would be an ambassador for a Purple Heart person. Mm-hmm. And Gold Star families would be for Gold Star families. But that's what broke me, I think, is just getting with other veterans that had similar experiences. And I know since 2016, I've helped prevent probably 3 suicides. The first one was a young man that him and his wife weren't getting along. She didn't come to the weekend with him. First night we were there, he was down by the fireplace drinking beer and talking with everybody. The next night he didn't show up. So I kept calling him, texting him, and he didn't answer. So finally I decided to go up to his room, and I could hear him bawling his eyes out.
And still going? Still chatting?
Are you recording?
We are recording.
Real quick, sorry to interrupt. John, you talking about the plaques at the Hall of Fame?
Yeah.
That's actually at Rhodes Tower.
Oh, is it?
Right, it's really close to where your hotel. It's right across from the State House.
Okay.
On Broad and High Street.
Oh, really? Because it's right here?
It's a block and a half from your hotel.
All right, because
I'm staying. I think it's on the first floor.
Great.
And that plaque should be up.
Great.
I want to make sure I knew what building you're talking about. So if you plan to visit, the tower's open, I think, till 4:30 p.m.
Great.
For access. So.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry to interrupt.
Thank you. Where was I? And he was having, him and his wife were having trouble. They were talking about getting divorced. He had 2 kids. And he was just bawling his eyes out. So I knocked on the door, and finally he came to the door. And I asked him what was going on. He told me. I said, well, let me talk to your wife. So I talked to her, told her how much it meant to him for her to be there with him. And she finally came, and when she came, his attitude and everything just changed. And to this day, I still get pictures of their new kids that they've got, and they're such a happy couple today, and I know that without him being at that particular program, he probably wouldn't have made it. He'd probably been one of the suicide victims.
For non-veterans, how can, I'm not a veteran myself, I mean, I work with veterans a lot and I hear stories, and I'm always curious, you know, how can we, that we simply cannot know those experiences and connect on that level. What are things community members who haven't served in the military, are there certain things that we can do? That
yeah, there's,
can
there's volunteers. Yeah, volunteers at, and it's called Blue Skies for Good Guys and Gals. And if you go to that website, there's a application for being a participant or whatever. And we stay at Camp Chautauqua, which is outside of Franklin. So we're all in barracks and cabins and stuff. So you really get to know the people that you're there to sponsor or be an ambassador for a lot better, because we used to be in the Hilton, which is down in Dayton there. And you really not to, you know, other than that day when you were taking them around to the different events, you didn't really get to talk to them a lot. But this is really a good thing. So that's my plug for Blue Skies and Good Guys. But when I came, you know, as I got a little more, it took me 25 years to go to the wall. And we were, I was working for Sprint at the time, and we were doing some training in Washington, D.C. And I went with another guy and a girl, and when we got off the airplane, he was driving, and I assumed we were going to our hotel, and he drove down to the memorial. And it was kind of odd, but I went to the panel right where they were at, those 11 that were killed that night. And we continued to do that through our reunions with the first CAV group. What we started out 2 years ago was going to the people who were killed, going to their hometown where they're buried at, and do a little ceremony for the family and friends and stuff of that particular individual, because all they knew was he got killed in Vietnam. So we give them a little bit of the history of what we knew of him and stuff. And it's amazing how appreciative they are for us doing that.
Yeah, just spreading their story and sharing it.
Yeah, and I've got a diagram of the actual battle site where we had and listed all the enemy that was in the surrounding area that had us surrounded. But it's really been a good thing for, I think, not only myself, but for the families. The last one we were at was in Utah, and he was a lieutenant, and he was killed there at that Battle of Angel's Wing. And they brought about, I think there was probably 100 people or more, and had a little picnic for us afterwards, and we were able to sit down and talk to the family and share any information we had with them about their particular time in Vietnam. So it's been a good thing for us as well as the rest of them. But we try to get together. It was 5 years. Now it's down, it went down to 3 years and went down to 2 years. And now since we're getting older, we try to do it every year someplace different. This year we're doing it in Kansas City. So, but I volunteer a lot just to get those thoughts out of my mind. Because if I sit for too long, boom, one of them will come in on me. And I also now see a hypnotist at the VA. And that hypnotist has helped me get better sleep at night, because there's a way to actually go through like the hypnotic state. And I record it all when I'm there, and I can play it back, and it helps me get to sleep and relax.
So, even all these years later.
Doesn't
leave you.
Yeah, it's been 54 years, and I'm still in that state where something will trigger one of those incidents, and it's just not a good place to be.
Yeah.
So, but anyhow, my wife and the rest of my family has just really helped me get through and past what I've been doing. Plus, I think just keeping myself busy, because every day I'm doing something with veterans, because I'm a commissioner at Veterans Services in Warren County, and every day I'm working with veterans, and it seems like it's every day of the year. So I think that's right now I'm at a good place. There is one of these that I would like to read. This is a poem that was written, and I think it's pretty relevant. But it's on the first page, sorry. Missing, it's called "He Lives Again." Missing in action, the telegram read. Somewhere near Kum Song, this was the day of his glory. This boy I was pleased to call my son. I see him coming down up the walk, two steps at a time, as he lives again in memory, this tall young son of mine. I stand before his picture. He smiles at me, and then time stands still in those precious moments when my boy lives again. In other words, he may not live to walk this earth among men, but each time his name is spoken, then my boy lives again. I thought that was a pretty dynamic poem.
Yeah, the importance of keeping, just talking about people who are no longer here, but right. As you share their stories, and like you're saying with the families, being able to talk about details helps them picture their loved one and remember them. And you can remember them. It can be painful, but it can also be, you don't want to forget them.
Well, and I think we're facing the same thing that I faced when I came home. I carried that load on my shoulder for 25 years and wouldn't talk about it. And I think the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are in that same mode right now. And what I do at the end of my speeches, usually when I give speeches, is tell them to please go out and tell your story. Get with another veteran, tell your story that had similar experiences. It will help you. And hopefully that word will get through to them.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sitting down with me and sharing some of your experience. I know there's more, but I really appreciate all that you do for your service and the continued service that you're giving to the veteran community, and for spending time with me today.
Well, and I've been on the Mason Memorial Committee since it started in 1998. And last year we installed a Purple Heart Memorial and a Gold Star Family Memorial. So those are pretty proud moments for me. I've been working with the city ever since I started doing the projects like Memorial Day, Veterans Day, and all that. And all I have to do is ask them. They're so, they do it. And it's just amazing the things that they've allowed me to do. And they sponsor Boy State program, which is held in Miami University now, and that's in the June time frame. Last year I sent 14 boys from our community to Boy State. This year I've only got 10 right now, but it's still a good group.
Yeah. Well, thank you, John.
All right. And Mason, thank you.